Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. There's something about listening to an album on vinyl that just appeals to our senses in a way that digital music simply cannot. Despite living in an age of subscription-based streaming where access to all the music in the world is pretty much at our fingertips, there's a growing movement of music lovers who balk at the audio quality of anything other than vinyl. Spinning on a finely calibrated record player, of course. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. Joining me today is longtime radio broadcaster and operations manager of NRG Media Northwoods, Duff Damos, along with NRG Media radio personality, Tony Rio. Jaron Childs, a true vinyl enthusiast and WXPR radio volunteer, is also with us today. Welcome all of you to Route 51. I'm so excited that you're joining me today.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
Well, all four of us kind of has something in common. We're all music lovers, right? And I think we probably all have ridiculous album collections. So today we're here to talk about what it is that makes music on vinyl so magic and utterly irresistible. We also welcome calls from listeners. Join the conversation at 800-780-9742. You know, across the country and here in central and northern Wisconsin, records have made a huge comeback, especially over the past 5 or 6 years. And Duff, you've been in radio for a very long time. After CDs and digital music took over the studios back in the late 80s, did you ever think there was going to be a market for vinyl again someday?
Never. That was the compactness of everything. You know, you didn't have all this room you had to take up with CDs. And although I personally could tell the difference between the CDs and the albums. And you say ridiculously large Tony here. He's got a huge album collection. In fact, he went this morning and bought a whole bunch of stuff. But I was one of those guys years ago when the record companies came in and said, hey, they've got compact discs now. Here's a catalog. Just check off whatever you want to replace your albums. So I did all that, and I gave all my albums away.
Oh,
I had tough. Beatles and cellophane still unopened. I had all that stuff.
No.
Yes. Don't tell anybody.
We'll keep it between us.
That's between you and I. I don't want to look stupid.
Well, Tony, you didn't do that, did you?
No. Well, no, not intentionally. I went through some life issues and such with marriages and such. So a lot of my records from one of my previous years when I was a kid and when I worked in the music industry ended up with somebody else.
I had
to start recollecting here about 10 years ago.
I think there's a country song in there.
Yeah.
I think
a lot of country
there
songs
is.
Like that.
Jaron, how big is your collection?
It's about 1,200.
1,200?
LPs or something.
Okay.
But I never
got way more than me.
But I, when I was a teenager, I was listening to punk and listened to kind of a lot of indie rock and underground music. And so I guess I never stopped collecting. Like the bands I listened to have
sure.
always made LPs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, really, vinyl singles hit 228 million units in 1973. That was the first year that was tracked by the Recording Industry Association of America. Then LPs, EPs hit their top at 341.3 million in 1978. And then things started to kind of fall off. Vinyl shipments fell off. And I mean, I guess really vinyl kind of died in the 80s, tucked our albums away, all our collections, and we started buying CDs or getting them. What was really the catalyst that brought it back? I mean, what was it? Like for you, I know, Jaron, you said that the artists that you like, you know, they kept
correct.
On
yeah.
with vinyl, but most did not. So, I mean, what do you think happened? Tony, maybe you can answer that.
Well, for me, it was, you know, as you grow older, you look for things that remind you of your youth.
Oh,
and,
for sure.
And I grew up in a family that really was a musical family, or at least my mom was. So I spent all of my teenage years listening to the family stereo, and we owned, my parents owned some commercial property. We had a company that was renting from us that was a music distributor, an import music distributor. I started working for them in high school, and it just kind of always kind of ballooned from there. So a lot of what I collect, everybody collects for a different reason, but a lot of what I collect is stuff that reminds me of being younger and, you know, better place, better times, that sort of thing. It's really it's a big nostalgia thing for me. I listen to a lot of bands currently that I listen to, you know, when I was 14, 15, 16 years old.
Sure. Sure. And I have to say that it's nostalgia for me, too. And much of it is anyway. I still remember the first album that I bought at Innersleeve Records in Wausau with my own babysitting money when I was a teenager.
Wow.
And I have to play a clip because I pulled this up and I haven't listened to this in forever, but here's a clip. All right, that was the first album I bought with my own babysitting money.
Wow. What an album, too.
Right. Yeah. Bad Out of Hell from Meatloaf, one of the best ever. And every time I hear that song, it brings me back. I can see the album cover in my head. I can remember taking the plastic off and reading the liner notes and then taking it over to my friend's house and playing it over and over and over again. And that's when we listen to both sides of the record. We listen to the whole thing, right?
Yeah,
well, yeah, absolutely. And when you had double albums, you had an even longer party.
Oh yeah,
yeah. It was quite an album, and I'm glad you brought that up about liner notes. That was the downfall for me when the CDs came out. Although it was convenient, you still didn't have that experience. You didn't have all that stuff that was stuffed in the middle of an album, or sometimes they put little trinkets in the album. Buying an album back then was an experience. A CD, not so much anymore. And I think a lot of people missed out on that.
Yeah, and I don't know about you, but buying an album now, today, again, is once again an experience. And that's a cool thing. What do you think, Jaron?
Well, and yeah, I think we're talking about the having a physical experience kind of accompany the oral experience and you know, I've kind of witnessed it with my own children. You know, they're 9 and 6, and you know, we had a CD player for them and CDs, and they just didn't really interact with them. And they also have a kind of a portable turntable, and you know, you can look in, and they're kind of sitting in the living room, holding the album cover, reading the lyrics, mm-hmm. kind of looking at all the illustrations, and that's just something that kind of went missing with digital media, you know, the physical interaction. And the digital media has this kind of impermanence that the ELPs don't have, too. You can lose your hard drive. There are these mm-hmm. these mm-hmm. little files, whereas, you know, you have this physical thing you can hang on to.
And a sense of ownership, too.
Yeah.
And I enjoy using Spotify when I want to stream music. That's great. If I'm on vacation, I'm not
Certainly.
Taking my album collection with me
right.
and my suitcase record player. But you don't own that music when you're streaming that. I mean, vinyl records are that physical item that you can collect and hold in your hand. Do you guys have favorites? That I mean, like, what's your favorite all-time record, Jaron? What about you?
Oh, I have this record that's called the Kinshasa Sound, which is just compilation of African music that
okay.
from the 60s that I just love.
That you just love. Yeah. All right, Duff. What about you?
I'm one of those where. You ask me right now, I'll name something, and then in 3 minutes I'll go, oh, no, wait, I want to change. There's just so many, and for different reasons, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's hard for me to say what my top one of all time is. Pink Floyd I love because of the technology and the production value of the Pink Floyds, obviously, and mm-hmm. sitting in your room and headphones on and forgetting the rest of the world for 50 minutes or whatever was quite an experience. But yeah, I cannot put a definite, that's my favorite album of all time. I just can't do it.
Yeah, for me, it's I have always been a huge Replacements fan. Band out of Minneapolis, St. Paul. Started out in the late 70s, early 80s, kind of as a punk band, and grew into a little bit more of a pop band. But they're kind of in the middle of their catalog is an album called Pleased to Meet Me. And to me, it's the last real Replacements album before it became the lead singer Paul Westerberg's influences on the music a little too heavy. But yeah, to me, that's probably the one that gets spun the most at home. But I collect a lot of different genres for different reasons. So I think in all of those genres, I have a favorite in each of them, you know, and they're all kind of equal. But I always have to go back to my Replacements collection.
Oh, my husband is a huge Replacements fan, too. He would echo that. I was looking at some sales figures, and for a long time, Michael Jackson's Thriller was the number one selling album of all time. I mean, it was for years. But finally, last year, it was this one. The Eagles' Greatest Hits, 1971 to 1975, finally surpassed Michael Jackson as the top-selling album of all time. Here's just a little bit of that clip. And I love those Greatest Hits albums. Don't you just to have that all of that your favorite stuff at your fingertips like that? I think is so amazing.
The only thing that drove me nuts about Greatest Hits albums is they would put the short versions of the songs so they get more songs on the album.
Oh, you know what? I didn't think about that, but that's true.
That would drive me crazy. That was blasphemous to me. You don't do that. But, no, I agree. That when they'd come out, the Rolling Stones coming out with the Greatest Hits or whatever, that was, you couldn't wait for that date.
Oh, I know. You marked it on your calendar.
And you talk about classic rock, too, you know, the Eagles and Meatloaf and all those bands like that. You know, what most people don't realize, in my opinion at least, is that I find that any record collector, you know, everybody collects for different reasons, but any record collector that I know always seems to have a foundation of classic rock albums in their collection, because classic rock has become one of those things, even though it was music about, you know, protest or war, you know, that sort of thing. It's a genre now that has kind of eclipsed everything and is very accessible to everybody. So I always say that, you know, one of the reasons classic rock is so popular is because everybody can appreciate it, and it becomes a foundation of many good record collections. It's a way that when, you know, I want to geek out about my record collection to somebody, I can bring them into my record room and I can start them on classic rock and use that as a way to introduce them to more obscure stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I have a friend who's, I think she's 31, and she's huge into records, but she's not buying the new stuff on records. She's getting the older stuff that her parents played when she was younger. I think that's pretty cool, too, that that the 20 and 30-somethings, they're really buying, and they're the ones buying the most vinyl, by the way. They aren't buying the new stuff. They are buying the old stuff. I think that's awesome.
My daughter's 32 in Milwaukee, and she goes to these shows down there. And her collection is what my current collection was 40 years ago. It's amazing how she's, Dad, I picked up Pink Floyd's The Wall. I went, what on earth?
Yeah.
But she's having such a wonderful time of it, and she's collecting, and she's got all these apps on her phone that shows, oh, this has this serial number, this album is worth this. So she's into the collecting part of it, too, and it's very cool to see younger folks like that. It's like brand new to them, too, which is neat.
It is neat. Well, we do need to take a break. Duff Damos, Jaron Childs, and Tony Rio, our guests today on Route 51, as we continue our discussion on the magic of vinyl records. And when we return, we'll play some more clips, delve into the great digital debate, and you can join the conversation, too. The number to call, 800-780-9742. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Duff Damos, Jaron Childs, and Tony Rio are our guests today on Route 51, discussing the magic and the resurgence of vinyl records in central and northern Wisconsin. We'd love to hear from you, too. The number to call, 800-780-9742. As a jazz person, this is one of my all-time faves. I'm just huge on jazz, and there is nothing like jazz. on vinyl. I want to talk a little bit about surface noise. When you put that needle on the record, there's a little bit of crackle no matter what you do, no matter how well you clean the record. I mean, is that what makes vinyl special, that or is it something that contaminates the sound quality? Jaron, maybe you can answer that.
Personally, I'm not bothered by it as long as there's not skipping.
Skipping.
You know, but other than that, it's just kind of the nature of the medium, you know. And I think what's interesting about it is when you have kind of digital files and everything is there's a sameness, mm-hmm. no matter, you know, if there's an MP3,
sure.
everyone on earth listens to the same MP3. It mm-hmm. sounds the same. And, you know, your record is messed up mm-hmm. in the way that your record is messed up. You know. And,
well, I think that even with a few pops and crackles,
yeah.
that's kind of the warmth
Absolutely.
To it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
yeah. Right.
What do you guys think, Tony and Duff?
Well, I know there's when you start getting into some of the online communities and all that about record collectors, there's always that perception that you always need to be better. You always need to have better equipment, a better copy. It needs to be cleaner. It needs to be quieter, that sort of thing. I agree with Jaron. I think part of the great part about vinyl is that it's that constant game of trying to get perfection out of an imperfect medium. You know, vinyl is not the perfect medium for music. It's fragile. It gets dirty. It degrades over time. But, you know, part of the fun of it for me is the game of trying to make it sound as good as it can. But at the same token, you know, that pop and crackle, every record tells a story, you know, not just in the music, but in who has held it and how it's been treated and where it's been through time. And that's really special about it.
It's funny you'd say that, too. I smile when I'm playing an older song on the air. Obviously, it's all computerized. But I get to a certain point in some of the songs, and I'll start smiling because I'll turn up the monitor, and I'll listen for, I'll go, right here is where I used to have a big scratch in that album.
Yes.
And it's so weird to say, but there's a Grand Funk song that I remember that I had a real odd scratch, but it almost was like an effect they put in the album that nobody else had. And I'll sit in the studio and I'll go, oh, remember when I had that on vinyl? And here's where that scratch was. So that's a pretty good salute to vinyl when it can affect you like that.
Exactly. And it also kind of reinforces this idea of it being a physical medium. You know, you can watch, you can look at your turntable and you can watch and you can see what's taking place and pretty much understand kind of where the sound is coming from and how it happens versus when you're listening to a digital file. You know, I don't understand how a computer works, and so there's some distance there, too. You have to attend to the turntable. You have to go flip the record. You have to, you know, so you're
sure
engaging in a relationship mm-hmm. physically.
And let's talk about technical. So vinyl is analog, but I mean, what does that mean exactly when you hear vinyl is analog? Tony?
Well, to me it means a lot of your newer pressings are mastered down and recorded down from a digital master, which has been gone over and scrubbed and washed and computerized so many times, whereas the older stuff was from the original analog tape masters. And that's really where you had more imperfections, and it wasn't as easy to really remaster or master a recording. So you're hearing the analog, the humanness of that recording process.
You would actually hear the, if you listen to a lot of Led Zeppelin albums, you'll hear John Bonham's pedal squeaking.
Oh, yeah.
And to me, that still gives me chills to this day that it was just so raw like that.
Yeah, nowadays that would all be edited out.
Exactly.
You know, and you really lose what makes music special in the first place is that it's a human construct.
It feels live
yeah.
in a way.
I feel like that really shows up in jazz. Like you listen to the jazz recordings from the 50s and 60s, and you know, everything's just live, and you know, they may even recorded it with a very small number of microphones, mm-hmm. and now, you know, some of the newer recordings, everything is so clean. And sometimes I feel like you lose some of that kind of group feeling, or, you know, the excitement that happens in a room when a band is playing.
I feel like recording quality has evolved significantly over the years. Yeah. Do you think that's true?
Yeah.
Especially
in class. I feel like in classical music, I feel like it's really evident. And I actually, with classical music, I find that I prefer newer recordings.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, which okay. is off topic.
Well, no, that's all right. That's all right. Yeah, I guess I always wondered what it meant when an album is remastered. So you really explained that. But, all vinyl degrades every time you play it, right? Thicker vinyl is supposed to degrade more slowly. Is that right?
Well, typically, you know, when you start talking about saying like 180 gram vinyl, or now you're starting to see more of the 240 gram and such. You know, it's a heavier record. It's a thicker record. It's cut deeper, that sort of thing. I mean, I can show you stuff in my collection from the early 80s, mid 80s that, you know, when KTEL and such was putting out a lot of stuff and they were just cranking it out as fast as they can. And, you know, those records were near as thin as a piece of paper, you know, and they're recordings that just haven't held up. So, yeah, thicker is better. But, you know, there's a lot to be said for, you know, proper maintenance and what I call love rituals about vinyl, you know, and part of that whole appeal of vinyl is not just the music and the sound that comes from it, but, you know, it's something to take care of. It's something to love. It's something to take pride in.
And you know, with the thicker records, you're seeing virgin vinyl, and some of those thinner, older records that you're talking about from the 70s and 80s, some of those were kind of recycled vinyl. And so even just like physically, the quality of the material is inferior. And these newer pressings are, these thicker ones are really nice.
I love the colored vinyl that I'm getting. So I'm in this record club, and I buy most of my albums at Innersleeve here in Wausau. But I am in this record club that sends us these really cool special limited releases every month. I've got My Morning Jacket Z. It's pressed on this beautiful white disc, for example. I mean, that kind of stuff is kind of fun. When did that colored stuff start? I don't remember that from way back in the day.
Oh, they did that years ago,
did
too.
They?
Yeah.
Little kid, they had see-through yellow vinyl, and I remember my parents having some old like Frank Sinatra or Victory at Sea.
Right.
Why would anybody buy that?
Yeah,
right.
I've seen 78s that were colored vinyl.
Right.
Yeah, that's been going on for a long time, which brings me to the 80s, mm-hmm. when the record companies would send us picture discs.
Oh.
Which were very cool. I don't know if anybody remembers.
Oh, I do remember that. That's
The actual album cover would be the album would be the or some kind of different artwork or picture of whatever. I remember the Brothers Johnson back in the day,
mm-hmm.
Strawberry Letter 23. It came to the radio station, and it was red and it smelled like strawberries.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah, it was. Back in those days, the record companies do anything to get you to play a record.
Oh, sure.
You'd sit there and you'd put it on, you'd go, this thing's, and Blue Morning, Blue Day by Foreigner. I remember that coming in on blue vinyl, and it smelled like blueberries.
And that's what's really neat about the current record industry is that they're starting to get back to doing some of that. I mean, I call it gimmick stuff, but it's fun. I had mentioned I had worked for a record distributor back in the day, and we were primarily import stuff from Japan, Germany, UK, that sort of thing. So most of what we carried was real limited edition stuff, but it was the colored vinyl, it was the shape discs. If anybody remembers those, where they would actually cut the vinyl out, the picture discs. You know, I can still remember getting the copies of Rolling Stone Sticky Fingers that actually had a leather cover with the zipper on it. You know, and that's starting to come back, and that's what's, you know, it's just another aspect of collecting that makes it a lot of fun.
Right, right. We have a caller who has a question. She wants a little advice. It's Gina from Phillips. She has some 78s from Russia, and she's wondering if any of you know where she would go to sell those. What's the best place to sell those to somebody if she wants to do that? Anybody know?
There's a website called Discogs, D-I-S, COGS.
Okay.
Which is basically all people sell everything there on vinyl.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's a great site for shopping on, and you kind of buy from individual members. And
okay.
I would, if you wanted to sell them individually yourself, otherwise, I don't know.
Okay. All right.
Discogs is kind of the Google of the record industry, the collector industry. It's anything and everything, it certainly seems like. But, and I don't know if Darren has run across this too, where, 78s are strange because you would think that because they're older and they're rarer, there would be a bigger collector community. But 78s are, they're a funny breed. It's very limited to the number of people that collect those and really care for them.
Exactly. And the only place where I see, and she might have luck with this, is it seems like there's a lot of collectors who are into kind of world music or international. You know, I think we always run into all the kind of big band stuff around here, but there's a really great blog called Excavated Shellac where this guy... he collects 78s from all around the world, and then he, gets good recordings of them and cleans them up and puts them on this blog, and then, writes like an entire page.
Okay, and what's that website?
ExcavatedShellac.com,
okay.
And
okay.
It's amazing.
All right.
And then you can download it all, and it's...
Okay. Jenna, or Gina, rather, from Phillips, thanks for weighing in on that, and I hope that helps you. Can we talk about live recordings for a minute? I have to say that I love the live recordings even probably more than I love the regular recordings. And I have to think that they are more complex to record. I was looking. Rolling Stone named its top 50 live albums of all time. Now, at the top was James Brown's Live at the Apollo from 1969, but this one ranked pretty high up, too. We're going to play a little clip here. And this has got to be one of my all-time favorites of live albums as well. A little Peter Frampton there from Frampton Comes Alive. That, to me, the excitement of the live crowd is just something amazing. Is it, Tony, do you know, how does the process differ when you're recording a live album from is that a harder thing for record producers, do you think?
Well, I think so, because, it's a one and done kind of thing. You either get it or you don't. In a studio, there's, you see movies and such, and it's always the joke of, okay, we're going to do this for the 87th time, this 3 second clip. So live music is definitely, harder to record. And I think that's why you see some of the engineers that I've known through my career, are in and around the music industry. There's guys who are studio producers and there are guys who are live producers. And they don't normally kind of switch back and forth. From personal experience, I can tell you way back when I was a kid and the Grateful Dead were still touring, I went to a couple of shows and we always got taper tickets, which basically meant we could bring in a tape deck and some microphones and do a live recording. And it was always this sense of adrenaline flowing, because it was like, okay, we're here and we're only doing this once, so it's got to be right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Keep in mind too, even back in those days, it brings to mind a Three Dog Night live album, which isn't a bad album, but it's raw and it's. I think they just held a couple mics up, and that was the end of it. Frampton Comes Alive and a lot of those big albums, they actually take the raw tape, which they're taking off the soundboard, obviously, and they go back in the studio and they'll enhance things. Frampton Comes Alive is not the raw recording.
Okay.
Recorded over a few concerts, and they did go back in, and they will, re-track the vocal and clean them up, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, yeah, it is live, and they're doing their thing. But they did put a little makeup on him once in a while, which was good, too, because, like you said, look how big that album was. Humble Pie, Rockin' the Fillmore, one of my favorite live albums, and I can actually say that. It's a favorite. And they did go in, which Peter Frampton was in Humble Pie years ago, but to hear a live album like that back in those days and have it just an incredible sound and incredible engineering, they did go in and clean things up a little bit. But for the most part, yeah, it is the live album.
And sometimes there's live albums that are kind of records of a pivotal moment in a genre. Like there's the John Coltrane Live at the Village Vanguard recordings, and that was you know, that kind of residency, you know, that stretch where he was playing with that group, that was kind of a game changer for a lot of other musicians, and it was a real kind of turning point.
And some music just comes across, some music just comes across better in a live format. I don't know that Peter Frampton's songs that were on Frampton Comes Alive would have really made great studio hits.
And that's what's cool about that album is a lot of the songs on Frampton Comes Alive sound better than the studio versions that he had before the live album.
Right, right.
I have a fairly extensive jazz collection also, you know, and most of it is live, you know, because nothing really comes across in the studio like jazz does live. It's capturing that moment and that energy in that small room in front of that small audience.
I couldn't agree more. There's nothing like a live jazz album for me I just love it. We do need to take a break. Duff Damos, Tony Rio, Jaron Childs are our guests today on Route 51. We're going to continue this conversation on the magic and surging popularity of vinyl records. And when we return, we'll talk about cover art, liner notes, those things you won't find in any digital download. And you can join the conversation too. 800-780-9742. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life. And if the other word tries to reach for hell, that's a mighty long time. But I'm in fact, punch a higher floor.
We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Duff Damos, Jaron Childs, Tony Rio, our guests today, discussing the renewed popularity of vinyl records, which seem to have risen from the ashes. They're certainly once again appearing in record stores and homes across central and northern Wisconsin. We'd like to hear from you, too. The number to call, 800-780-9742. Music aside, I think one of the best things to me about buying a new record is studying the amazing cover art and reading all the liner notes inside the album. I just feel like you can learn so much about the artist and about the music, and you can often find the lyrics to the songs, which is a complete bonus, and that adds to the overall experience. I still remember buying the Purple Rain album, which we just heard a clip from. Not such a spectacular cover, in my opinion, but the liner notes told an awesome story. So, I don't know, Tony, maybe you know, when did liner notes really become a thing?
You know, I don't know when it started, but one of the things that I love about liner notes, and I've got a collection, I collect vinyl, I collect CDs, I collect cassettes. And in my vinyl collection, I run about 2,500 to 3,000 records, and I think I've read every liner note on every album that I own. And what's great about it is that the liner notes are normally, sometimes they're written by production assistants about, you know, what was going on during the recording and where this came from and lyrics and such. But you find so much of this stuff that was actually written by the artist. And it's a direct line into what the artist was thinking about the music and how they saw it to be produced and how it came to be. And it's really this really special insight into the music itself.
Yeah, I know sometimes it's a journalist who writes them, or sometimes a copywriter. I know Hunter S. Thompson wrote for Warren Zevon because they were buddies. But yeah, most of the time, yeah, you got this insight into what the artists were thinking, maybe when they wrote the song or when they produced the song, what was going on in their life or in their mind or in the studio.
And when I started buying vinyl, I was listening to kind of late 80s, early 90s punk and hardcore, and lived in a small town. It was before the internet, and so you couldn't really hear music before you bought it. And so, you know, we'd have to drive up to Minneapolis, and, you know, you pick up a copy of Maximum Rock and Roll and thumb through the back, and you'd look at the album covers and the names of the bands. You'd look at the fonts they used, you know, that there were all these kind of aesthetic clues that would come from the cover art, and then you'd like order something in the mail, and you'd wait 6 or 12 or yes. 20 weeks yes. for this thing to show up and give it a shot. And so I think there's a lot of information that's communicated in all of these visual decisions. Mm-hmm. And then with kind of punk and these kind of experimental and underground bands, because it's a lot of people who were kind of doing it themselves, you'd see a lot of like handmade covers, mm-hmm. handmade cover art, you know, where the band is actually making the mm-hmm. art and that just kind of
right.
made right. a further connection.
We've got Lee from Wausau on the line. Hi, Lee. Are you there? We may have lost Lee. I apologize for that. But Lee actually was talking about being the proud owner of the Butcher album and wondered if you guys are familiar with it, because the cover art is apparently very interesting and a little bit controversial.
The Beatles, you mean?
It's the yeah. Butcher album, yeah. And I'm sorry, we lost him on the phone.
Yeah, with the babies and stuff. Yeah, that was, if he's got a copy of that, he's got a few bucks there.
Yeah? Well, okay.
Yeah, most of that, what that was is, what Beatles album was that? That was Then and Yesterday, something like that. And what had happened was they did a cover with the Beatles where they had raw meat and doll parts draped upon them. And, you know, at the time, that's a little racy. So what they did was they took a second shot and pasted over a sticker over the original cover of a picture of just the Beatles with guitars and suitcases, I think, at the time. So if you have an unadulterated, and they call it a Butcher cover, that did not have the sticker on it, that's something pretty special.
Lee, I think we might have him back. Lee, are you with us? Nope. Okay, still can't get him. Sorry about that, guys. But yeah, I'll have to look that one up, because that is not one that I am familiar with.
Yeah, that's the Beatles Yesterday and Today, it's called.
Okay.
Okay. Waiting to get online here.
Okay. Hey, I've got to say that LP sleeves are big enough that you can really appreciate the cover artwork. It really completes the experience. You got the music. The artist wanted you to have it that way. You look at the cover at the same time and understand its meaning. So even if the record dies, you keep the cover and place it on your wall for decorations. I know they sell, actually, frames that you can put album covers in. Anybody do that?
To those in my office. You remember in my office, I had a bunch of those. The record companies would send you those.
Mm-hmm.
It was neat because you could change your artwork every week if you wanted.
Oh, sure.
Which was very good. I think they still sell them, too.
Yeah. When I worked, again, for the distributor, we were one of the first ones. That's actually started in the UK. We were one of the first ones to bring those into the country.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay. Do you have some favorites? I mean, who's got a favorite album cover?
Oh, man.
Yeah, there you go again with that favorite thing.
Hundreds.
Yeah. I know.
Sticky Fingers, the Rolling Stones. It was just so creative. And Andy Warhol did that. With
yes.
the actual zipper on the, which caused a lot of controversy back then. But, boy, I can't put a favorite on that one either. There's so many.
I always liked a lot of the album covers for, like, Boston or Kansas or Asia, mm-hmm. Because they were, you know, kind of that, not psychedelic, but it was kind of like a futuristic cover, a lot of color, a lot of original artwork. You know,
yeah.
It wasn't just a picture of the artist. It was somebody actually sat down and thought about this and drew this out.
The prog rock group, Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Incredible album covers. They were artwork.
Mm-hmm.
My early teens were ruled by the Iron Maiden album cover. So I
okay.
Oh, sure.
Many,
sure.
many hours trying to copy those. And
the Santana albums, those covers were fantastic, too. I believe we have Jim from Austin online. Jim, hi. Nope.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, good.
Thanks for
yeah.
taking my call.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey,
questions. I gave all my albums to my daughter and son-in-law, who are decorating their living room with them, and I think I still have a box of them somewhere in the attic or something. And I'm just wondering if the heat affects them, just because it, you know, it gets to 120 degrees or so up there. The other thing was a Marantz 2270 amp. Is that are there amps that work well with albums? My son, when he was a toddler, he was playing with the buttons, and then when I turned it up, I blew two of my speakers out with it.
Wow.
It's a little loud.
No, the Marantz is nice.
Yeah, boy, I'll tell you, you can do a whole nother show just on vintage audio gear.
We were talking about that earlier. It's just we should do another show on old receivers and analog receivers. Marantz was perfect.
Yeah, hang on to that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that Marantz, putting some money into it and getting it fixed and getting it redone.
Definitely.
Those are great, great equipment.
And the albums in the attic, they could warp. I mean, you got to be careful. Depends on how you place them. And if they're flat, then that should be okay, right, Tony?
No, vertical.
Yeah.
And then they won't warp, right?
Yeah.
Vertical.
I always tell people with storage or records, you know, you want to be right in the middle, meaning you don't want them in the attic and you don't want them in the basement. You want them on that first floor, okay, Second floor, where it's climate controlled.
Get a walk-in cooler.
Yeah.
But moisture. You don't want moisture.
You
really don't want moisture.
Okay.
Yeah, I went out this morning and bought a bunch from a gentleman. I bought about 30 records this morning, and unfortunately came from a household where he smoked. So I've got some work ahead of me with those, but you know, it's that kind of thing. It's like fine wine. You want to take care of them.
You remember the smell of an album when it had been in your basement for a long time and had that moldy smell?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I remember that.
That damp funkiness.
Yep.
So,
is there any way to repair those at all?
To repair like dust jackets that smell moldy? Oh, warped records?
Basically warped, yeah.
Some people I've seen online, I've looked at a lot of forums, and everybody has all these kind of folk remedies. But one thing that some people have had success with is sandwiching the LP between like two pieces of glass and putting it in the sun. I've never kind of bothered. If something's warped, I just kind of let it go.
Oh, kind of melted back into shape, you mean?
Yeah. I don't. I mean, another crazy thing that I've tried that it actually is amazing, which isn't doesn't have to do with warping, but extremely dirty records. You pour a thick layer of wood glue,
what?
And scrape it into the grooves
because it sounds terrible.
It doesn't bond with the vinyl, and so what happens is you let it dry for a few days. You put some tape in with it in between the layers, and then you can peel the entire piece of wood glue off, and it takes everything.
So all the dirt.
Everything. Like, I had this record, this Charles Mingus record, and I was just going to throw it away, and I just said, I'll give it a shot. And it sounds brand new. It's
really?
Yeah.
So wood glue, that's the way to clean the record?
Try it on something you don't care about, but I've had incredible success
with
it.
Try it on something you don't care about. I love it. That's great advice.
Back in the day, I remember in the studios, and Shireen will remember this, a lot of mozzarella cheese on our albums.
Oh, that's so true. That's
and it
so
really
true.
Didn't do much for the grooves either.
yeah, that's a good memory, yeah, for sure. Yep. Oh, wow. What about the best equipment? I mean, we talked briefly about the Marantz system, but I know that vinyl lovers got to be still spending some time and money on dedicated setups in their house. You guys have any suggestions on what's good to get? I have a pretty nice turntable at home hooked up into my Bluetooth system. And then at the office, I have a suitcase record player. It doesn't sound very good, but it's still fun to play records on. But what's the best stuff?
Boy, Marantz was always good. I had Techniques from Team Electronics back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Techniques and Technique speakers. Like I said, that's another hour, 2 hour show. Yeah. When you can Sansui and what other brand?
Well, and I always tell people, if you're going to get into vinyl and you're going to go for that first turntable, look for something that has an adjustable tone arm. Mm-hmm. Look for something that you can adjust the weight, that you can adjust the anti-skate on. Your suitcase record players, have a tendency to be a little harsh on records.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's great to get people into the hobby and all that, but spend a little bit more and get a decent turntable. My personal stuff, I have a tendency to tend more towards vintage equipment. Mm-hmm. I have a tendency to go more for kind of mid-road stuff. I like the idea of I'm listening to this record, this vintage record on vintage equipment that the average person would have owned it you know, back when the record was new. I listen, my jazz collection is primarily late 50s, early 60s. I listen to it on a 1961 Philco hi-fi system. My rock stuff and that I listen to, I'm very blessed. I have the stereo that I talked about earlier that my parents bought. I have that stereo, and that's what I still listen to records on. You know, as part of that whole nostalgia thing. But, you know, it's the receiver, the speakers, that, you know, all that's important. But if you're going to spend money and you're on a budget, get yourself a halfway decent turntable with, you know, that will allow for some adjustment.
Another thing to consider is it's becoming increasingly more difficult to have vintage turntables repaired. I'm not from Wisconsin, but it's my understanding that I have to go to Madison for the nearest repair. And so I think if there are people that are starting out who are looking for newer equipment, there's a brand called Project and Music Hall. Both make kind of a nice entry level. You know, they're like about $400 for a turntable, but they have a great sound, and you'd be getting something reliable. And
They're certainly in the Projects and the Regas and all that. There's certainly something that you can grow with. It's not a turntable that, you know, you're going to use for a couple of years and then go, I got to get something better.
It's amazing that you can still get parts for some of these turntables.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, yeah. I have to repair a lot of my own stuff, and I'm certainly no electronics whiz, but, you know, it's that's part of the hobby for me, too, is, you know, you run vintage gear, you're going to have to learn how to fix it at some point because it's northern Wisconsin, and there aren't a whole lot of resources.
Not a lot of parts here.
And replace your dang stylus.
Yeah.
You know, because you're going to damage your records if your stylus is old. And there's a place out of Minneapolis called Jerry Raskin's Needle Doctor. Needle Doctor. It might be needledoctor.com, but you can purchase styluses online for pretty much everything.
Or as they called them years ago, fangs.
Fangs?
That's what a needle was called, a fang.
I don't remember that. That's great.
Oh, yeah.
That's great.
I need a new fang.
Well, I've got to say, we so many times, you know, when we're out shopping, we see albums in stores that we didn't expect to see. I know Barnes & Noble carries some records now and things like that.
Urban Outfitters.
Yeah, but I still love the independent record stores and Chaos Radio or Radio Chaos Records in Stevens Point, rather, Inner Sleeve in Wausau. You know, Mike Capista's been there for so long. He's so knowledgeable, and it's just, I mean, it's a great place to buy records, don't you think?
That's where I'm going when this show's over.
Yeah, you said it.
I may see you there, Jared, because we're headed down to Wausau here in a couple hours. So and then probably Randy down there.
Does he still give the inner sleeve?
Yes, he does.
He does still give the inner sleeve, yes.
That was a big deal back then. You get that inner sleeve, you'd replace it immediately when you got home.
You know, and when you get into collecting, and I know we're getting short on time, but when you get into collecting, it can be very intimidating because there's a lot of people who are very into it and seem very unapproachable. But Mike at Inner Sleeve and Randy at Radio Chaos are probably two of the nicest guys that you will ever meet. And if you go in there and you know, I don't know anything about records, but I want to start, what do I do? Their eyes light up, and they will be more than happy to help you.
Ask him about a fang.
That sounds good.
It's supposed to be fun.
Yes, that's just it. It is supposed to be fun. Well, I've got to tell you, that's all we have time for today. We could have gone another hour here. This is Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. I'd like to thank our guests, NRG Media Northwoods Operations Manager Duff Damos, NRG Media Radio Personality Tony Rio, and WXPR Volunteer Jaron Childs. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Our on-air producer today is Joy Ratch Kramer. Special music today from Miles Davis, Dave Brubeck, Prince, Pink Floyd, The Eagles, Meatloaf, and Peter Frampton. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route 51. Next week, we'll explore the ways in which art therapy is helping ease the pain of PTSD in veterans throughout central and northern Wisconsin. Until then, we're heading out of town.
Wexberg on his short story collection.